Asia summit, Joe Biden said his focus was on the Georgia Senate race in December. The loss of the Senate will focus minds sharply on Donald Trump's ongoing dominance of the Republican Party. Fissures have opened up, with some prominent Republican figures openly appealing to Donald Trump not to announce a 2024 run, as he is widely expected to do next week. Trump himself has lashed out at popular Republican figures who may rival him, such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who was a rare Republican success in the midterm elections as he easily won re-election and flipped several once-strong Democratic districts, especially in Miami, Florida. The website of CBS News has also covered the same story. Democrats will continue to control the U.S. Senate following the 2022 midterm elections, after Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto on Saturday was projected by CBS News to win a tight re-election race against her Republican rival Adam Laxalt. Her victory gives Democrats 50 seats in the 111th Congress. Vice President Kamala Harris' tie-breaking vote, should it be needed, gives them the majority, regardless of the outcome of the Georgia runoff election in December between Senator Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger, Herschel Walker. The election is a great win for the American people, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said in a briefing late on Saturday night. With the races now called in Arizona and Nevada, Democrats will have a majority in the U.S. Senate, and I will once again be the majority leader. A pleased Joe Biden, who is in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, attending the summit for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, told reporters on Sunday morning that Chuck Schumer has got a majority again. "We're focusing now on Georgia," Joe Biden said. "We feel good about where we are, and I know that I'm an optimist. I understand that from the beginning, but I'm not surprised by the turnout. I'm incredibly pleased with the turnout, and I think it's a reflection of the quality of our candidates, and they're all running on the same program. There wasn't anybody who wasn't running on what we did. They're all saying and sticking with it, and so I feel good." Before Election Day, some Republicans had begun to believe that Senate control was within their reach, since President Biden is suffering from underwater approval ratings amid high inflation and voters' negative views of the economy in all of the battleground states. But in the months before the general election, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed doubt that Republicans could take the Senate, which he blamed on candidate quality. Many of the Republican candidates who lost were far-right candidates endorsed by former President Donald Trump, which gave them momentum during the primary season. But they failed to appeal to independent voters and moderate voters in general election. Senator Pat Toomey, who is retiring from the Senate and whose seat was won by Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, blamed Donald Trump for the missed GOP opportunity. "The data is overwhelmingly clear. The more candidates who are associated with Donald Trump and the ultra-MAGA movement and this false notion that the election was stolen from him in 2020, the more that was the message, the more they lost. And in many places, it was a stark to a more conventional Republican who was winning," he said in an interview on Fox News Channel. Though he didn't identify him by name, Pat Toomey referred to the far-right Republican candidate for governor, Doug Mastriano, as a weak candidate who loses by 15 percentage points, the most for an open seat since the 1950s. He went on to note that, "We lost three opportunities to flip House seats, lost control of the state House, and the party needs to get past Donald Trump." Alaska, while three candidates are on the ballot in a ranked choice voting system, has also not yet been called, but with the top two finishers both Republicans, CBS News is projecting it will stay in Republican hands. On Friday evening, CBS News projected Arizona Senator Mark Kelly will win re-election over his Republican challenger Blake Masters. In other battleground states, CBS News projected that races in Wisconsin, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina will go to the Republicans, while Democrats will win in Colorado, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania. In each of the Senate battlegrounds, where CBS News has conducted exit polls, voters said control of the Senate was important to their vote. CBS News conducted statewide surveys in 11 key battleground states in Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, New Hampshire, Nevada, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Wisconsin. In each of these states, voters had a negative view of America's economy.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the Democratic Secular Republic of India has in recent years under the BJP government transformed into a Hindu majoritarian state. And we shall also look at attempts being made by right-wing forces in India at the behest of the Hindu nationalist government to convert mosques into Hindu temples.
The democratic, multicultural, and secular Republic of India is gradually being transformed into a Hindu supremacist state with a rapid shift towards majoritarianism and communal polarization. During the 8-year Bharatiya Janata Party rule, religious intolerance has become more pronounced in the country. One of the searing indictments of the Narendra Modi government's anti-Muslim bias is the Bilkis Banu case. A Muslim woman who was gang-raped by a Hindu mob after 14 members of her family were killed. The rapists were scandalously released on India's Independence Day recently.
The report card of the Hindu nationalist BJP government's 8-year rule in India presents a grim picture. While the period has been defined by divisive politics and anti-Muslim violence, one particular incident that has become the emblem of the Hindu majoritarian politics of the ruling party is the Bilkis Banu case. Her lonely fight for justice dates back to 2002, when the western Indian state of Gujarat saw the worst state-sponsored massacre in post-partition history. Hindu mobs torched Muslim homes and businesses. Modi was the chief minister of Gujarat at the time, and an inquiry found him responsible for the pogrom that killed more than 1,000 people, including Banu's family. Her 3-year-old daughter was smashed on the ground, according to court documents. She was brutally gang-raped and survived with those scars. In 2008, following a high-profile trial, 11 men were sentenced to life in prison for rape and murder. Many thought that justice had been done finally. But this August, the state government granted them remission under a controversial provision in India's criminal law that allows prisoners to be freed once they serve 14 years. The ruling proved once again that the fight for justice never ends in BJP-ruled India.
When India broke the shackles of British imperialism in 1947, after centuries of struggle, its founding fathers envisioned a secular, democratic, multicultural republic. Over the years, the world's second most populous country also emerged as one of the world's fastest growing economies. However, the slide into majoritarianism began less than a decade ago when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party rose to power under the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. BJP's meteoric rise has seen the gradual erosion of human rights in the country.
The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party has used the toxic political ideology of Hindutva as its trump card since it first came into being in the late 1980s. However, since the party's second coming under Narendra Modi in 2014, BJP has aggressively promoted Hindutva, which human rights activists believe is primarily centered on divisive politics, communal polarization, and hate. The ruling party has also used it as its prime election strategy in general and state-level elections in recent years, reaping rich dividends. While other political parties, including the Congress with largely secular leanings, have been consigned to oblivion. Hindus constitute the overwhelming majority of India's 1.4 billion population, with Muslims making up around 14%. In recent years, emboldened by the Hindu Nationalist Party's pro-Hindutva slant, right-wing groups have intensified the chorus to declare India a Hindu state, where Muslims and other minorities would be second-class students. It has further alienated Muslims and fueled hate and violence against them. Controversial moves by the Modi government, such as the 2019 Citizenship Amendment Act, the revocation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in 2019, Delhi's anti-Muslim riots in 2020, and more recently, ban on hijab in schools and use of bulldozers to demolish Muslim homes and businesses, have been seen as collective punishment for Muslims.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Asif Mojtaba, the founder of Miles to Smile Foundation. Mr. Mojtaba, welcome to the program, sir. Now, how did the secular multicultural republic of India, as envisioned by its founding fathers, transform into a Hindu supremacist state known for its majoritarianism?
See, this is one basic question that people often ask, that how easy it became for the Hindutva nationalists to transform the multicultural, multilinguistic, secular country like India into the pathway of a Hindu republic. So like an old saying that Rome wasn't built a day, this road to Islamophobia, this road to hate, and this road to Hindutva chauvinism wasn't built a day, right? So it was created right after the independence of India in 1947. From 1947 till 2014, see, 2014 is the year when the Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, came to power. People often consider it as a pivot, as a starting point, as a fulcrum from where the oppression and demeaning and lynching of Muslims started. But as a matter of fact, if you look back 70 years from the independence, there has been numerous instances of mob lynching. There has been numerous instances of riots and pogroms. There was a major in the same month, there was a Sikh genocide that occurred. Similarly, there was a Nilai massacre in 1983. There was a Bhagalpur massacre in 1989. There was Malyana, Meerut, Hashimpura. So I could count numerous occasions when the riots happened. And when these riots or pogroms or genocides were happening, the Congress, the party which considered itself to be a champion of secularism in the country, the party who considered it that they gave the word secularism to the constitution that wasn't there. So this party was in power. And despite being in power, they did nothing to stop the rise of Hindu nationalist groups like the RSS.
Mr. Mojtaba, we could say that the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has successfully used anti-Muslim violence as an effective election strategy in recent years. So what does that tell about the largest democracy's electorate?
So if you talk about how easily the BJP, the Bharatiya Party, rose into electoral prominence using anti-Muslim hatred and riding the Hindutva wave. So I would say, like, see, BJP is one political party. Similarly, Congress is one political party, Samajwadi is one political party, and there are numerous political parties. Every political party has some political ideology, that is to win the electoral seats. So winning the electoral seats in majority, forming the government at the center or at the state level, these are the ideological of all the parties. So to gain to power, these political party adhere to numerous other ideologies. So and similarly, there is one Hindutva that is religious ideology. I would say Hindutva is a fanatic religious ideology that considers like non-Abrahamical religion. Very sharp difference between Abrahamical and non-Abrahamical religion. They have a sharp distinction between the religion of the soil, like Hinduism, Sikhism, and Buddhism, Jainism, and the other foreign religion, like alien religion, like Islam and Christianity. So different political party wore Hindutva cloth. I would say Hindutva is like a cloth. So these political party, whenever these Hindutva clothes suited them, they wore it. And when they didn't suit them, they took the other cloth out. So similar is the BJP. Like, so people often confuse BJP with Hindutva. BJP is a political party that is wearing the Hindutva ideology for now. But the irony part is there was Congress that has been switching off and on with the Hindutva cloth, like for long. So one of the most powerful prime minister under Congress, she was Indira Gandhi. And if you look at the Indira second part of power after 1977, she was very comfortably riding on the Hindutva ideology. She wore Hindutva cloth and she was riding on the Hindutva ideology. And that's why when she was murdered in 1984 by two of her Sikh guards, and there was a large-scale anti-Sikh riot that happened exactly a week before, these days in 1984, the RSS was leading the genocidal mobs at numerous places.
And last but not least, the harrowing memory of the gang rape of Bill Gaspano and the brutal murder of her family members in Gujarat was refreshed recently with 11 accused men being released by the apex court. Now the question is, do you think the right-wing fanatics enjoy the patronage of the BJP government?
See, the very first thing that they were not released by the apex court. This question was raised in the parliament as to who gave sanction orders for the early release of these convicts. And in the written reply that the minister got, it was clear that the CID of the state was against their release. The Women Commission was against their release. But the Ministry of Home Affairs or the Home Ministry, they gave orders for their early release, not by the apex court. Bilkis case is one horrendous episode in the Gujarat riots. It was very horrific how 9 or 10 members of a family the women were raped and they were brutally murdered. How one among the crowd, one of the convicts, they snatched Bilkis' son and killed the 3-year-old and put in the fire.
There you have it, Mr. Mojtaba, the founder of Miles to Smile Foundation. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Human rights lawyer and author Arsalan Iftikhar writes that India is heading down a right-wing rabbit hole led by Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is trying to erase Muslim identity across the country. Ravi Agrawal, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, quotes from an article by historian Ramachandran Guha on how Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's personality cult will have deeper consequences for the country. Academic researcher Mubashra says Islamophobia is central to the Hindu nationalist movement as it seeks to remake India into a Hindu-only nation, leaving behind over 200 million Muslims.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since 2014, when the Bharatiya Janata Party came into power in India, the country's 200 million minority Muslims have complained of persecution, hate and violence. At the heart of this majoritarian project have been mosques and monuments and desperate attempts to convert them into Hindu temples. This obnoxious project, vigorously promoted by the Hindu nationalist government, involves rewriting India's history in line with the majoritarian Hindutva ideology by converting mosques and monuments from the medieval era into temples.
While incidents of hate crimes, mob lynching, discriminatory citizenship laws, incarceration of journalists and activists, anti-hijab campaigning, and demolition of Muslim homes and businesses have been the highlight of Narendra Modi's 8 years in power, the campaign to convert Muslim heritage sites into Hindu temples has lately gained momentum. BJP leaders and their ultra-right-wing ideological patrons claim that Muslim Mughal rulers destroyed 36,000 Hindu temples and it was time to reclaim them. From Varanasi's Gyanwapi Mosque to Mathura Shahi Idgah Mosque, Lucknow's Tiliwali Mosque, Bhopal's Jama Masjid, Karnataka's Malali Mosque, a vicious campaign is underway in India to raise down mosques. Historians argue the claims made by BJP leaders are baseless and outlandish, accusing them of inventing a history of their own to serve their political agenda. A series of petitions have been filed by right-wing Hindu groups against mosques across the country in recent months. In Mathura, a city in Uttar Pradesh state, the Shahi Idgah Mosque built by Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb in 1670 alone faces 12 lawsuits. The 17th century Gyanwapi Mosque in Varanasi is also embroiled in a legal case. Even a world-famous monument, the Taj Mahal, built by Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, has not escaped litigation, with extremist Hindus claiming it was a Hindu temple containing Hindu relics.
The issue of mosques and Muslim worship has been at the center of BJP's communal politics since it rose to power on the back of a countrywide campaign over the destruction of the 16th century Babri Masjid in 1992. BJP claimed the mosque was built on the site of the birth of the Hindu god Ram, and its demolition in December 1992 marked a watershed moment in India's post-partition history. In 2019, the country's top court, in a snub to Muslims, handed over the mosque to Hindus.
The 400-year-old Babri Masjid in the small town of Ayodhya in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh was razed to the ground by Hindu fanatics on December 6, 1992. It was estimated that more than 2,000 people died in the orgy of communal violence that swept through the country following the mosque's demolition. 4 years later, in the general election, Bharatiya Janata Party almost doubled its tally in parliament from 85 to 161, using the same Hindutva card. The campaign to build a temple at the disputed site in Ayodhya was later at the center of the party's anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat in 2002, which left more than 1,000 dead, the majority of them Muslims. During the pogrom, Muslim homes and businesses were identified and targeted by Hindu mobs. Hundreds of mosques and shrines were damaged. A medieval-era Muslim shrine in the city of Ahmedabad was razed to the ground. Following the massacre, Modi clinched state elections, proving again that anti-Muslim violence was the party's trump card. After Modi became the prime minister in 2014, the right wing felt emboldened to target mosques, ban the use of loudspeakers for azan, criminalize the wearing of hijab by Muslim women, and stoke communal tensions. Top Muslim political leaders such as Asaduddin Owaisi have drawn similarities between campaigns to convert mosques into temples with Babri Mosque demolition.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Bangash, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the BJP's majoritarian project has been centered around converting mosques and monuments into Hindu temples. Now, the question is, does it help the party's political fortunes?
Oh, of course. One of the planks of the BJP and the Hindutva Brigade is that they want to destroy all the mosques in India on the false allegation that these mosques are built on former temples. That's not the case at all. In fact, when Muslims ruled India, Muslim rulers not only protected the Hindu temples, but in many instances, the Muslim rulers actually provided land for the Hindus to build their temples and provided financial support for these temples to be built. Because Islam not only recognizes other religions, but there is a strong projection that Muslims must respect the religious places of other people, even if they disagree with them, as obviously Muslims do with the Hindus, because Hindus are mushriks, they have multiplicity of gods. But Islam prohibits targeting them or destroying their places of worship because this is what Islam enjoins upon its adherents. But we see in India that the BJP has taken this campaign, launched this campaign to target mosques, destroy them on the false allegation that these mosques stand on the grounds where there used to be temples. Muslims are prohibited from building new mosques, and when they can't find places such as mosques to pray, when the Muslims come out to pray outside, then the Hindus attack them there as well. There have been many, many instances in which Muslims have been attacked while they have been praying. So this right-wing fascist ideology that is raging throughout India has targeted the mosques in particular as well, because mosques are seen as symbols of religious identity for the Muslims. So this is part and parcel of the Hindu ideology, and by whipping up anti-Muslim sentiment among the majority of Hindus, the BJP tries to cash in on that vote. And since they constitute an absolute majority in India, when out of 1.2 or 1.3 billion people in India, Muslims are about 200 million, the Christians are probably about 20 million or so, and although the Dalits are about 200 million, but they have also been incorporated into the Hindu religion, despite the fact that the Dalits are discriminated against viciously.
Mr. Gosh, BJP leaders claim that Mughal rulers destroyed thousands of Hindu temples and made mosques. Now, does this claim carry any weight in the light of historical records?
Yes, indeed. The demolition of Babri Mosque back in December of 1992 was a watershed moment in the history of Muslims in India. Now, that mosque in Ayodhya was built by the Mughal Emperor Babur in 1528. And Babur, of course, was a Mughal ruler. And the Hindus claimed that the Babri Mosque was built on a place where the Hindu god Ram was born. But it's interesting to note that there are two other places in the same city, Ayodhya, where the Hindus claim that their god Ram was born. Now, obviously, Ram could not have been born in three different places simultaneously. But the Hindu myth that they were propagating was because the Babri Mosque was a fairly imposing structure, and it was built by the first Mughal emperor Babur, and that's why the name Babri Mosque. and they wanted to show to the Muslims that the Hindus can get away with it. And that, of course, proved to be the precursor to this Hindutva campaign, in which the BJP members were actively involved. That campaign, the demolition of Babri Mosque, was led by L.K. Advani, who was at that time the leader of the BJP. But Narendra Modi was part of that campaign as well. And he was honing his murderous skills under Advani's patronage. And this was part of his sort of training that he participated in the campaign to destroy the Babri Mosque. And as a consequence of that, and by getting away with it, now the BJP and the Hindutva Brigade are going around in India destroying other mosques.
And last but not least, sir, like you mentioned, the demolition of Babri Masjid in December of 1992 marked a water-washed moment in India's history. Now, the question is, can we draw any parallels between this and the campaign to convert mosques into temples today?
In India, attempts to ban the hijab of women, to ban the azan, etc., is a very serious omen for the future of Muslims in India. We know that even a former foreign minister of India, Salman Khurshid, who had written a book in which he had said that these Hindutva terrorists, the RSS and other terrorists in India, are the equivalent of Daesh or ISIS. And for that, Salman Khurshid's house was attacked and set on fire. He wasn't there at the time, but these Hindu terrorists can go that far. And Salman Khurshid had actually served as foreign minister in the Congress-led government. So if these Hindu terrorists can go that far, then we know very clearly as to what would be the fate of ordinary Muslims in India. They are discriminated against in education. They are discriminated against in employment. They are discriminated against in getting jobs, for instance, in the judiciary. Even when they try to set up businesses, their businesses are attacked. There are examples of several states in India where ordinary Muslim vendors are not allowed to have their push cart stalls on the streets, with the police saying that you are blocking traffic. But there are no such restrictions for Hindu push cart vendors. So in other words, Muslims are being undermined not only politically but economically and socially. And if economically they are undermined, then obviously it would be very difficult for Muslims to survive in India. And this is a major threat to the presence of Muslims in India.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Bangosh, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Akash Hassan, a journalist, shares a Guardian report about how thousands of mosques are being targeted across India as Hindu nationalists attempt to rewrite the country's history. Law professor and author Khalid Baydoun notes that Islamophobia in India is as sweeping as bulldozing Muslim homes and mosques, and as petty as preventing a Kashmiri Muslim photographer from traveling to claim her Pulitzer Prize. Zafarul Islam Khan, a scholar and former chairman of Delhi Minorities Commission, writes about court cases against a 17th century mosque in India, noting that the purpose is to fatigue Muslims.
And that was our episode about the growing religious intolerance and political polarization in BJP-ruled India and the Hindu nationalist government's project to convert mosques into temples. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. Considering the current state of the U.S. economy, experts and economists are predicting recession in the United States over the next year. The national debt of the United States is increasing every second, and the total national debt of the U.S. has reached more than $31.2 trillion. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered this story. According to a Wall Street Journal opinion poll, high inflation is increasingly creating major strains on all Americans, including those with higher incomes than others. The poll, which was conducted by the paper by John Anzalone and Tony Fabrizio, the chief pollsters for President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, respectively, found that 26% of registered voters with household incomes between $100,000 and $150,000 said inflation is creating major financial strains for their families. That figure is up from 19% in August and 14% in March. The share of Americans with household incomes between $150,000 and higher who reported major financial strains because of inflation remained stable compared to August, but rose significantly from March. 54% of Americans with household incomes of $60,000 or less also indicated major financial strains, up from 51% in August and 47% last March. Annual inflation hit a 40-year high earlier this year before softening in recent months. But price gains remain at elevated levels, and the monthly consumer price index, the CPI, has risen at an increasing pace for the past two consecutive months. Like many other surveys, inflation clocked in as the top issue for voters in the poll. 34% said it was the issue that made them the most likely to vote, and more than half ranked it as either the number one or the number two issue. Elevated price gains have caused political headaches for U.S. Democrats and the Biden administration. Republicans have released a barrage of attacks on the issue during their midterm election campaign. 48% of registered voters in the poll said they trusted Republicans in Congress more to handle inflation, the highest level recorded in the last four surveys, which spanned the course of the past year. 27% of respondents in the new poll trusted Democrats more to get inflation under control. CNN has also covered the same story. According to a closely followed University of Michigan survey released on Friday, 11th of November, consumers were feeling slightly worse about the U.S. economy in November amid punishing rate hikes and decades-high inflation. According to estimates on Refinitiv, the preliminary index reading from the monthly survey of consumers showed sentiment fell to 54.7% from 59.9% in October. Economists were expecting sentiment levels to tick down to 59.5%. It's the lowest reading since this summer, when sentiment bottomed out after gas prices hit a record high in June. The survey showed that sentiment slumped both for the current economic conditions as well as for those in the near future. Surveys of consumers director Joanne Hsu told Bloomberg in an interview following the report's release, sustained high levels of inflation as well as rising interest rates are weighing on consumers, who are also expecting the labour market to weaken in the year ahead. Joanne Hsu said consumers don't think we're out of the woods yet. The survey also showed that consumers' inflation expectations for this year and 5 years out remained relatively unchanged. This key data point for the Federal Reserve showed that the median expected year-ahead inflation rate was 5.1%, up from 5% last month. According to the data, long-run expectations were at 3%, holding in the same 2.9% to 3.1% range for 15 of the past 16 months. The U.S. Federal Reserve is closely watching for shifts in consumer expectations to determine if inflation is becoming entrenched in the United States. If consumers believe prices will remain high, that could factor in to increased wage demands, which, in turn, could cause businesses to raise prices. The data for the surveys was collected prior to the midterm elections, as well as Thursday's better-than-expected Consumer Price Index, CPI, which showed inflation slowed down to 7.7% in the month of October. The Associated Press news agency has more for us. According to a recent opinion poll, a third of American public say they have fallen behind financially, twice as high as the number of U.S. voters who said the same back in 2020. According to an Associated Press votecast, over the past year, prices have skyrocketed and the annual inflation rate has hovered around 8%. Ordinary expenses, including groceries, rent and gas, are eating into Americans' paychecks. A third of Americans said they're not confident that they can keep up with the expenses. About half of voters in the survey said rising grocery prices were the most significant concern for them, much higher than gas, housing, and healthcare expenses. Recent 2022 polling shows that Republicans are poised to take over the House of Representatives, but they have failed to take over the U.S. Senate. GOP candidates across the nation have hammered Democrats on the economy throughout the campaign cycle. According to an Associated Press survey, half of voters said inflation was a significant issue that factored into their vote, while 44% said the future of democracy was a major concern influencing their vote. Meanwhile, Americans are split on whether President Joe Biden is to blame for the high inflation rate, which half in the survey said the president was at fault, and another half said there were other factors outside of his control. With odds of a split U.S. Congress rising, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned that lawmakers' failure to raise the statutory limit on U.S. debt posed a huge threat to America's credit rating and the functioning of America's financial markets. Janet Yellen told Reuters news agency in an interview on Friday, 11th of November, she said, cooperation is still possible between Republicans and with Republicans on some issues, but lifting the debt ceiling is a non-negotiable item. Some Republicans have threatened to use the next hike in the $31.4 trillion debt ceiling as leverage to force concessions from President Joe Biden, a Democrat. America's public debt stood at $31.2 trillion on Wednesday, 9th of November, and without an increase, analysts anticipate a potential default crisis by the third quarter of 2023.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian warns of negative consequences if the UNHRC were to go ahead with demands of the West. He criticized the Western double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. In a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said, "Contrary to the UN Charter, few Western countries exploited the peaceful demands in Iran and encouraged violence and offered tutorials on building weapons and Molotov cocktails on media and social networks, which led to the killing of police and insecurity in Iran." He says that if a session is to be held on the riots in Iran, it should in fact probe into foreign governments' role in encouraging violence and terror and not on the country that is a true defender of human rights. What Amir Abdullahian is referring to is the piling evidence of actual foreign involvement in the riots, perhaps the most compelling of which was revealed through a joint statement by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence. In it, the country's two top intelligence bodies pointed out the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the riots. They revealed that they have gone as far as dividing the riots in different stages of pre-unrest, during unrest, and post-unrest. Perhaps the primary way foreign governments, especially the US, UK, and Saudi Arabia, were involved was through supporting foreign Farsi-speaking media that played on people's emotions over a tragic death and capitalized on existing grievances to attempt to overthrow the Islamic establishment through something like a coup d'etat. Iran has warned the UK of consequences for hosting the so-called Iran International Channel, which Iran has recognized as a terrorist organization. Iran also warned Germany for voicing its support for the rioters and calling on the EU to implement more sanctions against Iran. Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, responded to the US cries of women's rights and human rights being violated in Iran and its calls for a special session to, quote, highlight the ongoing repression of women and girls and members of religious and ethnic minority groups by saying this. "The United States lacks the political, moral, and legal qualifications to hold such a meeting, distorting the very basic principles of human rights." He also added, "The US has no true and genuine concern about the human rights situation in Iran or elsewhere." Perhaps he was referring to the role that the US has been playing in destabilizing the West Asia region and carrying out terrorist attacks there. Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, and its unwavering support for Israeli crimes against Palestinians, don't even begin to tell the whole story on US's destabilizing acts in the region. The UK's involvement in Syria, funding terrorist groups, and being one of the coalition members of the fight against Yemen also nullifies their cries over human rights violations anywhere in the world.
As the war drags on in Ukraine, the gloomy economic outlook continues to trigger protests across Europe. Demonstrators in several European countries have hit the streets for pay rises and better working conditions. In the UK, tens of thousands of nurses will go on a strike for the first time, demanding better pay as the cost of living soars. The industrial action would begin before the end of the year, after the first vote on strike action in its 106-year-old history. Unions say that the salaries of nurses have dropped by up to 20% in real terms over the last 10 years. That has left members struggling to feed their families and to pay their bills. Hundreds of workers at London's Heathrow Airport will walk out in the run-up to the Soccer World Cup this month over demands for better pay.
The 700 workers will strike for 3 days, starting from November 18th. In Greece, workers have held a 24-hour general strike, which has seen thousands of protesters march to the streets of Athens and the northern city of Thessaloniki. Clashes also erupted between protesters and police forces. And the French capital, Paris, commuters have faced transport delays as metro workers called a major one-day pay strike. Unions have staged strikes across several sectors in recent weeks, seeking pay hikes or increased hiring as spiraling energy costs feed into widespread inflation. The protests come amid a gloomy outlook in Europe as Russia's war in Ukraine takes a rising toll on Europe's economies. The International Monetary Fund has predicted that Europe's advanced economies will grow by just 0.6% next year. It also says that this winter, more than half of the countries in the euro area will experience technical recessions. Germany, which is considered EU's biggest economy, is also expected to go into a recession in the next year.
The German economy has been built on cheap energy, cheap gas from Russia, and this business model is over. So Germany has to fasten to produce renewable energy and then go back on track with its business model. But this will take a couple of years.
Technically, a recession means that at least two consecutive quarters of shrinking output will occur. Next year, Europe's output and income will be nearly half a trillion euros lower as compared to the IMF's pre-war forecasts.
We have downgraded three times since October last year our growth projections. Last time we brought 22 to 3.2% growth, and for 23 projections was 2.9%. We will see, we always come around the annual meetings with our World Economic Outlook, that we are further downgrading our growth projections for next year.
The Eurozone has been battling against surging inflation for about a year. Inflation hit a historic high of 10.7% last month. Given the historic levels of inflation, the European Central Bank has announced three rate hikes this year, bringing the main rate from negative territory to 1.5% currently. Soaring costs with energy have been the main driver of higher inflation across the Eurozone.
From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28 attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, these incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have spiked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence as an answer to unwanted results. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States, and the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6th Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority. From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28th attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home. These incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have spiked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence as an answer to unwanted results. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States, and the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th. November 15th at Mar-a-Lago